You're listening to a podcast of a program from the media archive of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Happy New Year and of our 2016 season of Aloud. Welcome to the library. It's great to see you here tonight. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the series, and I think we're going to have a really wonderful series ahead for you. In fact, I know we are. We've got some great programs coming up, so make sure you're on our mailing list, and if you want to become a member and support the Library Foundation, we can talk to you about it afterwards. We have our Aloud bookshelf set up, so we can gift you with a book by an Aloud author. We are still recovering from 2015 and our overwhelming event with Patti Smith, and there's more in store, so please make sure you're on a list so we can tell you what's coming up. Tonight, we have a special program for you. Brian Siebert, a dance critic and features writer for the New York Times, has written his first book, What the Eye Hears, A History of Tap Dancing. And critics agree, and I agree, this is the book on the history of tap. But it's also about so much more. It's about charisma, it's about fun, and it's also about racism and earning a living in America. It's about self-expression, about what it means to make it your own. It's about lineage and tradition and learning from one's elders, about seeking out knowledge. It's a fantastic read. Brian will discuss his book with another dance lover and perceptive critic, Sasha Anawalt, director of the USC Annenberg Arts Journalism Programs. Sasha's a leader in the LA arts community and the author herself of a best-selling cultural biography of the Joffrey Ballet. They'll save some time for your questions, so we will circulate mics. Remember to wait until the microphone comes to you, as we do record for podcast, and we are videotaping tonight as well. And afterwards, Brian will be signing his book in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. Brian was born and raised in Los Angeles. In fact, I think he was back in his hometown today, talking at his high school. So we thought we'd add some local talent to start the New Year's off with a festive touch. And our special guests tonight are performer choreographer Sarah Reich, one of the new leaders in the art form of tap. Sarah tours with her band, the Tap Music Project. And tonight she's here with her frequent collaborators, saxophonist and composer Danny Janklo, who's a rising star in jazz circles. He's performed and recorded with many of the greatest jazz performers of our time. And his own new band is called Sound Barrier. Brian Siebert's book covers tap's post-World War II decline and its more recent reinvention. There was a time, some of you may remember, how many of you remember, when tap was everywhere, it seemed, in musicals, in vaudeville, in clubs. I grew up with an uncle, Q Russell, please. See if he can come up. I grew up with an uncle who fell in love with tap as a youngster in Ukraine. And in America, he performed all over the country in vaudeville revues, and he eventually opened a little studio in San Fernando Valley. I remember him getting up on the table at bar mitzvahs and weddings doing tea for two, soft shoe. So I'm thinking that perhaps Uncle Roy is watching us tonight with his tap shoes on. So we will progress. Thank you, Uncle Roy. We're going to start tonight with a film showing the great tapper Bill Robinson. And take it away, Russell, and please enjoy the evening.
So that was Bill Bojangles Robinson. And now I'm going to read a little bit about what I say about him in my book. And that act, too. There was more to Robinson's act than carefree abandon. A key part of it originated back in 1918, when Robinson saw some friends in the audience at the palace and danced down the stairs to greet them. Thus was his stair dance born, or so he said sometimes. Other times, he said it came to him while he was dreaming of a different palace in England. In that dream, he stood at the bottom of a staircase, waiting to be knighted. I didn't like the idea of just walking up, he recalled, so I thought I'd dance up. I danced up the stairs to the throne, got my badge, and danced right down again. He said that his best steps always came to him in dreams. These stories are probably apocryphal, which isn't to say that they hold no truth. Professional black and white dancers had been clogging on stairs since at least the 1880s. King Rastus Brown claimed that Robinson stole the idea from him, though Brown almost certainly stole it from somebody else. Notwithstanding such antecedents, Robinson was viciously possessive. There's many a tale about what he did to those who dared use stairs. Stop the act mid-performance, slap the offender, pull out a pistol. Once, when the dancer Eddie Rector replaced him in a show, Robinson sent him a cablegram warning him not to do the stair dance on penalty of death. His effort to protect the claim was largely futile. When he attempted to secure a patent on the stair routine, the U.S. Patent Office denied the application. In the early years, he danced up and down stage stairs. Soon, he had a portable staircase built. The stairs were central to his act, his vaudeville gimmick, but they must have been important to him for another reason. They magnified the essential strengths of his dancing. The staircase was symmetrical. It was two staircases joined back to back, a terraced pyramid, five steps up, five steps down. Each step was just large enough to accommodate Robinson's 2 feet, and the connected top steps served as a platform. The entire staircase rose to the height of Robinson's ribs, and a triangle of empty space underneath it made for a resonant drum. Upon these steps, Robinson could portion out his own. These were mostly time steps, three and a break steps, and what the stairs did for Robinson was reveal how he played with the structure of the music through how he played with the structure of the staircase. He would become known for bringing tap, quote, up on the toes. In contrast to the flat-footed style of dancers such as King Rastus Brown, Robinson carried his weight over the balls of his feet and drew his carriage up from there in an erect line. It's as if he were trying to balance a glass of water on his head. His arms swung more freely than a clogger's, but for the most part, he kept his feet neatly underneath him, which is why his dancing fits so well on the stairs. The small space emphasized the extraordinary efficiency of his movements, his impeccable control. The height gave his floor-bound dance a vertical dimension, amplifying his rhythmic wit. The staircase was an extension of his instinct to dramatize. It used the eye to direct the ear. From the back of the theater, you could perceive that it was an instrument, each stair of which rang a slightly different note. The tonal distinctions were subtle, but then Robinson was a subtle dancer. The Eisden Shoe Company in Chicago made his clogs special order, 20 or 30 pairs a year. If one sole split, he discarded the pair. Using shoes with different levels of wear would have compromised the perfect balance of his sound. He liked to challenge people to go beneath the stage and try to distinguish his right from his left. An easy task with many dancers, impossible with him. Robinson wore out shoes by dancing often, not by dancing hard. Wood met wood, two equals. It was a warm sound, precise, but with a soft center. His taps were even, measured. Indescribably liquid, wrote the critic Robert Benchley, like a brook flowing over pebbles. The Chicago Daily News compared them not just with the, quote, steady beat of a racehorse's feet, but with quail's wings. Not with firecrackers, but with firecrackers heard in the distance. Audiences leaned in to listen. To imagine Robinson's stair dance, first hear a song such as Old Folks at Home, Swanee River, played in ragtime. He starts on the ground with a time step, marking accents with sharp nudges to the face of the bottom stair. Adjusting the angle of his bowler, he hops on a couple levels up and back. Then he repeats the rhythm by swinging his right leg up and skipping it down, turning the stairs into a tilted xylophone. His leg's momentum spins him around, and he hits an upbeat en route before finishing out the phrase facing his instrument. The next measure, he splits between tapping on the floor and patting the stairs with his foot. His knuckles handle the repeat. Then he's up and down the stairs, half a phrase on one step, the remainder on its neighbor. The complexity of the rhythms builds, then subsides, and builds again. The brook flows over more pebbles, or fewer, but it does not cease flowing. All along, his arms swing loosely, now drooping for a droll show of relaxation, now pushing out small circles as if to say, that's nothing. Sometimes he concentrates on one stair and sneaks it in a tap on the stair below it, or he slips a tap between stairs as he ascends. He scales the stairs backwards with just as much ease. For a while, he uses the top platform to showcase quick rolls and drum-tight wings. He keeps packing in more stairs per bar, subdividing the beat with stairs. By the end, he's running up and down the stairs. That's all he's doing, running up and down the stairs. But it's music, and it's magic, and he knows it as he struts off the stage. The dance thrills, but not with acrobatics or speed or even inspired rhythms. For much of the number, Robinson's rhythms are metronomic. He can be plain, but you can trust him. You can relax. The stairs are a stunt that conceals its daring. As generations of imitators would learn to their grief, the properties of the staircase that magnified Robinson's mastery equally magnify the slightest imperfection. Robinson's timing, his metronome sense, was legendary. Dancers tell a story in which he had the musicians cut out for 3.5 minutes while he continued dancing. After the allotted time, the musicians came back in, cued by a metronome that Robinson couldn't hear. He was exactly on beat. It was another sense of Robinson's timing, though, that would prove most consequential. Unlike, say, King Rastus Brown's stair routine, Robinson's signature number was filmed, most fully and simply in the 1932 all-black short, Harlem is Heaven. Bill Robinson came in at the right time. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that when the right time came, he was still there, on beat and in step. And now, on beat and in step, Sarah and Danny.
I spent the better part of my winter break reading this incredible book. And, you know, when Brian was reading, I don't know if it, what to me, what is so incredible, as he's reading, he is incorporating criticism, he's incorporating interviews obviously done with you've talked to many dancers to get that, but also, you know, I found that in looking at the clip, because of the way that he writes, with noticing things like the stairs and the size of the stairs, and noticing the up on the ball of the foot, and noticing the even the pebbles and the things that he's using help you or me see this dance better. And, you know, the title of the book, What the Eye Hears, is really what you do throughout this. It is a remarkable, there is no other book like this. This is the only start to finish tap book, tap history book that exists. And it is this incredible, incredible labor that I actually could not put it down. And I've told you this, I hadn't read a book as large as this since Anna Karenina. And I kept thinking
there was a
shortcut. So my question to you really is, I want to set the scene for why did you decide to do this book? How did you do it? It took 15 years.
Doing other things too, but yeah.
What insane motivation? Who are you? And
that's a different question.
Writing.
Thank you, first of all. Yeah. So you want to know like the genesis of the book?
The genesis of the book.
Narrowly, it came out of me being at Columbia University, getting in a master's degree program for writing and looking for something to write about.
Yeah.
And I had been in China for a couple of years before that, so a lot of the things I was writing about had to do with travel and what happened to me in India, and I had written an essay about Cambodian genocide and how there had been a tourist industry built around that, and I was talking to my professor about that, and she was kind of glazing over a little bit, and then I said I had to go to tap class, and suddenly she perked up. Mm. She said, "Oh, Brian, you're a tap dancer. Why don't you write about that?" And I thought, okay, and I went to find the book to help me write the little essay I was going to write, and there wasn't a book.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, okay, maybe I'll try to do that. And then a lot of time passed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, when you because you were a tap dancer, did that have a lot to do with this book? Or
I mean, somewhat. Tap had been one of the things I had done since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I checked this story with my mom after publication, mm-hmm. and she said it's true, but I got into tap dancing because I was really bad at soccer, mm-hmm. and my mom, who's here,
Yay, Mom.
She thought that dance class might make me more coordinated, but I liked dance class better than soccer, so mm-hmm. I kept doing that, among other things. But it was just like one of the things I did. When I started researching the book, I just learned over and over that I didn't know anything.
Uh-huh.
It was a thing I did, but for example, I didn't think of tap as music.
Yeah.
It was like a dance steps that I learned and could do, and it was fun, and it was what Fred Astaire did on TV. But I didn't know it was a form of jazz. I didn't know it was connected to everything in American history. I learned so much.
Well, that's the incredible thing with this book, is actually, to me, it is the history. It's a history of America, and it's a history looking at gender politics, at race politics, at history. When you ended your reading with that Robinson came in on the beat, mm-hmm. and he was there at the right time.
Yeah.
To me, this book is about this perpetual question with tap, like who's going to do it after? Can you talk about Robinson dying and then what happens then, but also what compelled you to go all the way back to the very, very, very beginning, and how did you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what compelled me.
Yeah.
Idiocy, quixotic something. But which question do you
want? So go with Robinson, like he dies and there's...
Well, so he, in that clip, he's already pretty old. Mm-hmm. He must be over 50.
Mm-hmm.
So he had, for a tap dancer, hey, I'm 40, all right? I'll try again. He had been performing for a very long time, many decades, before he found this fame, and that's what I mean with him being on beat in the right time.
Mm-hmm.
This is 1932 sound film. This being possible is only a couple years old at this point.
Right.
And he's still around, and he could still do it, and he could still do it at that level that we can
have it documented and have him seen. And then a couple of years later, he's doing Shirley Temple movies, who's the biggest box office star, and he becomes a big star. Mm-hmm. In a way that he couldn't be when he was on vaudeville, or even a couple of years before this, when he was starring on Broadway. A different level of fame.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about there. So, but by the time he died in 1949, he was hugely famous.
Yeah.
And his funeral, there were hundreds of thousands of people were on the streets of New York to honor him for his funeral. But tap dancers often say that that was the point when you need some sort of historical marker. And they say after Bill Robinson died, that's when things went south.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it is, it's a lot of the whole culture changed. A lot of the things that Louise was talking about at the beginning. So in the 30s and 40s, tap was everywhere. It was in the movies. It was on Broadway. It was in the nightclubs. It was in vaudeville. All of that changes after World War II. Broadway, Agnes DeMille comes in and brings ballet in. That becomes popular, so tap's out. In Hollywood, tap goes out of fashion, and then the movie musical goes out of fashion because mm-hmm. the studio system changes. So those movies aren't being made anymore. And then probably most important, theaters, where tap really lived, in the nightclubs and touring jazz bands. Theaters and nightclubs just close mm-hmm. for lots of reasons. Mm-hmm. White flight out of the cities, weird tax things that I get into, unions changing. So a lot of nightclubs close. Jazz itself changes mm-hmm. from music where you go dancing or you watch a show to like a listening music in a little club
right.
where there's no stage, no room for a dancer to dance. Rock and roll comes in, and for lots of reasons, some having to do with amplification, mm-hmm. jazz, a tap, and rock never get together. And you know, all of this stuff changes, and the way that the culture was, tap was at the center of the culture. By the mid-50s, 60s, it's not anymore. People are still doing it, but it's not at the center.
And so who rescued it?
Who rescued it? A series of people in the 60s, and then a whole new generation mm-hmm. of people in the 70s, mostly women,
mm-hmm.
mostly white women, educated women, college-educated women who came in and found it as a kind of a cause. A lot of them had maybe tapped when they were kids, and a lot of them went to college. And when you went to college for dance, that wasn't about tap. That was about modern dance.
Right.
You took off your shoes and you danced barefoot, because that's what was in the college. And then they learned about modern dance, but then they got a hankering for, well, maybe we can bring it, we can use what we're learning with modern dance and get back to the tap dance we love, bring it into find a new home for it, really, in modern dance venues, in grant applications, and that whole way of doing art. People found a way to do that, and also bringing back all of these dancers who had, you know, were semi-retired. They had jobs as stage managers or car upholstery or whatever they were doing, and, you know, getting them back and putting their shoes on, passing on the tradition.
Are we talking about Brenda Bufalino and
Absolutely.
Jane Goldberg?
Absolutely, Jane Goldberg, Lynn Daly here mm-hmm. in Los Angeles mm-hmm. With the Jazz Tap Ensemble.
Linda Sildenell,
Fred
Strickler. So at the time when women came in and were sort of doing some of this rescuing, there's an interesting part in the book when Honey Coles people say to his friends say to him, why are you doing this? Why are you giving this all this stuff to white women? And what does he say?
Well, according to Brenda Bufalino, who mm-hmm. I never interviewed Honey Coles,
mm-hmm.
He says, you know, basically because Brenda could do it. And she was the only one who wanted it, too. Another thing I didn't talk about with what happened after mm-hmm. Bill Robinson died mm-hmm. is that the perception of tap dancing, especially in the black community, changed.
Right.
And because maybe we'll get back to talking about where it comes from, but because it coming from slavery and minstrelsy, and they had certain associations of servility with tap dancing, that with the rise of black power and those movements in the 60s, a lot of the younger generation of blacks at that point thought of it as a shameful thing or an embarrassing mm-hmm. thing, and Bill Robinson as the worst case.
Mm-hmm. Because
of something to forget.
Yeah.
Because he did the movies with Shirley Temple, because he played a slave character sometimes or a servant, and because of some certain aspects of his performance demeanor, which mm-hmm. dated in mm-hmm. ways that went out of fashion.
One of the fascinating things I think in the book is talking about minstrelsy and the following the back and forth of corking the face and not corking the face, and what there's some remarkable stories. Can you think of a story that, because there's so many in here,
yeah,
we're talking
yeah.
about Willie Coven at one point, but
in terms of minstrelsy?
Let's talk in terms of minstrelsy.
Because that is really the way that tap became theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to go back even further,
mm-hmm.
Basically it is part comes from Africa,
mm-hmm.
and traditions that slaves brought from Africa, and the other half comes from the British Isles, mostly Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are mixing because blacks and Irish are at the similar social level,
right?
Like the bottom. Blacks and Irish were in the same neighborhoods often. Not only slaves, but free blacks, say in New York, the only places that they could live were the same places that people fleeing the famine in Ireland mm-hmm. could live, and they went to the same clubs, they went to the same dancing cellars, and mixing their traditions, which actually have a lot in common, if you go back and trace, you know, where the different things came from, and they're mixing, and that becomes the folk form, and then the way that becomes a theatrical form is in this weird mm-hmm. thing called blackface minstrelsy,
yeah.
which starting in, you know, the 1830s, 1840s, becomes the most popular form of entertainment in America. And what it is, you know, essentially is white people, because black people were generally not allowed on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, most of them were slaves at that point. We're talking before the Civil War. White people pretending to be black, which, as we could talk about in other ways, is mm-hmm. like a core thing that happens in American culture. It happens again in jazz, it happens again in rock and roll, happens in hip hop, and it starts in minstrelsy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're talking about, the ways that gets weird, is that, you know, after the Civil War, when blacks are freed, they start to go on stage, but the convention is already established of minstrelsy,
mm-hmm.
so then you have blacks doing blackface minstrelsy,
right.
which is some kind of black people imitating white people, imitating black people. And what the white people had been doing before might have been black people imitating white people, because there's a lot of that going on in slave culture. And you get this mirror game going that just gets stranger
yeah.
and stranger and stranger.
How did you keep your head straight through
I didn't. That? I mean, a lot of times, like, for years,
yeah.
I got lost in this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also so fascinating that I kept digging and more and more and more.
Yeah, there's a section in the book, I thought this is really interesting, if you don't mind if I read it, because there was an idea in the air: blacks could save white America from itself, set it free. Black rhythms, black tap dancing. To Alain Locke, however, it was the black performer who was in vaudeville chains and needed to be unshackled. Locke was a Harvard graduate, the first black Rhodes Scholar in 1907. A professor with a PhD in philosophy. In his writings, he argued for the importance and influence of Negro music, particularly the instinctive mastery of rhythm, stemming from a culture in which dancing was a natural and spontaneous activity. But Locke was even more worried than John Martin, who I assume is John Martin, New York Times, John Martin?
Right, right.
The first full-time dance critic in the United States for the New York Times. Another thing that Brian does through this is always reflect on what the critics and critical history are doing. Locke was even more worried than John Martin about commercial pressures, and he dreamed of black symphonies and ballets, not jazz and not tap, which he considered a terrible hybrid. A Bojangles performance is excellent vaudeville, he wrote in 1936, but listen with closed eyes and it becomes an almost symphonic composition of sounds. What the eye sees is the tawdry American convention. What the ear hears is the priceless African heritage. What was the heritage of black Americans? The gift, the contribution to modern art. What part of it was African? What part American? These questions lay at the heart of The New Negro, an anthology edited by Locke. And, you know, that picks up on your title for your book, but also so beautifully and succinctly diagrams the history of thinking about something that's very, very complex in many ways.
Yeah.
It's very. I don't know if does that. Do you want to comment on that particular section of the book?
Well, that just shows you, you know, that. So I was talking about minstrelsy, and this is 100 years later.
Right.
And these same issues are coming up again. This comes at the end of a section where in the 20s. Black shows on Broadway became really popular, and also that's the Jazz Age, and people are thinking about Black culture in a different way, and so all of these issues, you know, the same stuff just keeps getting mucked up again, and it just keeps coming back.
So let's talk a little bit about Noyes Funk and Gregory Hines and all that those, because we're going back and forth. I hope some of you have seen Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk, and Savion Glover, and Gregory
actually, we could
Hines
have a better
beforehand.
Segue than that, which is the time I'm talking about is the 20s, and the beginning of this period where Black shows were happening was started by this show called Shuffle Along. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you want to talk about Savion Glover and George C. Wolfe, they're about to do a show about Shuffle Along on Broadway.
Whoa.
In April, and we'll see how that goes.
Huh. Well,
it's the first time that they've gotten together since the 1990s when they did Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk, which was about a show about the history of tap dancing as a kind of metaphor for the whole history of African Americans.
Right. And that was one of the shows you saw that was a big show in your life.
Actually, no.
No?
I mean, it certainly became that. I became obsessed with it afterwards. But I do remember seeing it in college and, like, I didn't know anything, really. And I thought, well, that's cool. I really like what he's doing. And I didn't know to question you know, what was happening historically in that show until I did a lot of research.
Because the research sort of peels back layers on that show. And also, you know, I think there's also that instance you're talking with Bojangles to Robinson about stealing steps, and how I think it's so beautiful that Sarah and Danny danced after that clip, because it's about passing on and the constant
actually,
question.
Even better, what you guys didn't get to see is in the back in the green room, Sarah was dancing along with it. She can't even see it, but she knows all the steps, and she was doing it on the carpet back there.
Wow.
That's the tradition, you know, it keeps going.
Because a lot of footage.
A lot of footage, yes.
So the I think the beating question always through this is who's going to do it next? Where is it going to go? Who cares about it? What's going to happen to it? What is the future of tap? And you have the benefit of film, but then what's happening now with tap? You in with the internet and everything like that. What's the explosion? What's going on now?
Yeah. That.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about tap is that there's so much talent. And after Savion Glover, he inspired, you know, in the 90s when he came up and was young, inspired a whole successive generations of people to be excited about it again. And there are lots of great tap dancers. What the problem, and Sarah could talk about this too, I'm sure, is you know, where do you dance? Where does it fit in the culture? That's still like a troublesome thing.
So with Brenda Bufalino and Jane Goldberg tried really hard to and successfully to have companies.
Right.
And also to have festivals so that you go from a form that is individual and solo and
commercial.
Into companies. And then they had to disband their companies and, you know, why? What?
Well, I mean, the whole funding thing has changed. Some of that has to do with the way the NEA changed, other aspects of the culture. So the style that Savion Glover brought in, that kind of pushed out a lot of what the companies were doing as well. I think that, you know, just the whole how do you make a living as a tap dancer is still a big problem.
Yeah. And Savion Glover was so young. He was 15 years old. So now he's probably old as far as you're concerned.
He's 41. He's exactly my age, which is old.
He's exactly your age. So and he's sustaining it and evolving the form.
Absolutely. I mean, he's an amazing artist, and he blows me away all the time. This last summer, I saw him at the Joyce Theater, and I've been watching him closely for many, many years. And he was like, he did something else. He found another gear. It was like, Savion Glover can do more. Wow. But you know, it's also kind of when he can be an entertainer too. But what he does, his conception of tap dancing is like almost a kind of religious mysticism or something. He just gets deeper and deeper and draws more and more inward to the form, which I find amazing. A lot of people walked out of that show. Mm. A lot of people hated that show. So it's an amazing way to do it, but it's not the only way, and it can't be the only way.
Yeah. So I want to hit on some famous people too, Fred Astaire. It's very hard to have a conversation about tap without talking about Fred Astaire. But he didn't like being called a tapper or a hoofer, right?
Yeah, I mean, people ask him about it. He's a tap dancer. He thought, well, it's like one of the things I do. I'm not really a tap dancer, which is sort of true and sort of not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, like any great tap dancer, he did something with the form, and that's why he's great. He stole from everybody. And made something new with it, combining a little bit of ballroom adagio, a little bit of that, and that's part of what makes him great. I forgot the question.
I was just observing. I mean, I wanted to talk about Fred Astaire and what did he bring to this?
Yeah, I mean, we could sit here and just watch Fred Astaire clips all the day. He's in terms of film tap, he's the best. What he did in terms of making an art form out of filmed tap has never been equaled, I think.
So the incredible thing that you did is you sat down and you watched one film after the other.
I did. I watched everything, and the Fred Astaire was the good stuff. I also watched lots and lots of bad movies, like looking for 2 minutes of tap dancing in this film. Yeah.
And you did the same thing with Gene Kelly.
Sure. Yeah.
So what did you see in these? You see very different things. You see. With Gene Kelly, to me, you saw a commonality in all of his films. That was
He has a very limited vocabulary as a tap dancer, rhythmically. Mm-hmm. If you watch his films, you see the same couple steps over and over and again, same rhythms. It's in every number, right? That's his idea of rhythmic wit. And there are wonderful things about Gene Kelly. I love him as a performer, and he gets a lot of space in the book. He's very important for the history of tap dancing, but he didn't advance the art particularly, and in terms of rhythms, he's not that, he's kind of square. Mm-hmm.
Singing in the Rain, there's a big revelation in the book about Singing in the Rain that I certainly didn't know about. Can you tell everybody what it is, or do you want me to?
You can tell me.
So it turns out, and this is fascinating because in terms of, it turns out that Debbie Reynolds, that's not her tapping. And I did not know that. So here's a film about singing, changing, going to films with voice and
about that era, the switchover from silent to sound. And
right.
Part of the plot is about, covering the voices, right? Who's singing and she's singing, but we see that voice. But that was that was just standard for tap dancing because the way tap was recorded. It was shot first, and then afterwards, the taps in some studio, somebody would put together the taps, but it often was not the person who was dancing. So Ginger Rogers, that's never the sound of Ginger Rogers, the sound of Hermes Pan, who was Fred Astaire's assistant. And that's just commonplace.
Right.
It happens all the time. But, it's part of my title, too. It's about, what you see is not always what you hear.
And Fred Astaire did a lot, though, for film in that way.
Fred Astaire did his own dubbing, though, actually. So did Eleanor Powell.
Well, and also the bringing your own floor. You talked about the stairway as I love the idea of being able to go underneath and see if you can hear the difference between the left foot and the right foot.
That was part of the competitions too, going way back, even into the 1900s, is that there would be a judge underneath the stage too.
Oh.
judges out front, judges on the side, and judges underneath the stage to hear.
Huh. Wow, that's incredible. And also, there's seems to be a lot of priority on speed.
Sure. I mean, anytime you get, you know, an instrument that doesn't have a sustain, like mm-hmm. tap dancing, like drumming, it's going to get faster, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's going to be a thing to you know, in the one-upsmanship. I can do that, but I can do it twice as fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Savion Glover wrote a book, and I love in the book about how he talks about the sole of the foot as a drum set, mm-hmm. and that each part of the foot is that something that he thinks like that, or is that the way?
Yeah, generally tap dancers. That's just one way of describing that the instrument of the shoe has tonality.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not just doing rhythms, but you're trying to get different tones, even melodies, out of different parts of the shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the expressivity of the form musically.
When I was reading the book, I was a dance critic here in the 80s and the 90s, and there was quite a lot of tap in LA, and you know, I always felt a little bit kind of like I didn't really know how to look at it or how to listen to it. And I was when I was reading your book, I was feeling badly, like, oh my God, you know, I didn't learn how to look at tap. And there came this moment in the book that I realized I inherited certain things from critics that were, there was a common thought in the 70s that Walter Terry expressed, that tap was limited. And when I was growing up and going to Jacob's Pillow and going to tap, to dance festivals, very, very rarely would you ever, ever see tap. It was just, it was kind of shunned as a non-dance form, which was really strange. And I came to a moment in your book when you talk about those critics. And the reason I'm saying this is because I think Savion Glover and others have kind of liberated us in ways that we inherited also with women and women wearing shoes, high heels, and what kind of footwear women would wear and how do you think of the foot. So women come along, and the critics in New York, Sally Summer and Arlene Croce and Marcia Siegel, who I revere them enormously, and here they come along and they write, while Summer was suggesting that the young white women couldn't accurately emulate their mentors, Arlene Croce was arguing that they shouldn't. The reason women had seldom ventured into virtuoso hoofer territory, Croce wrote in The New Yorker, was that the technique was physically unflattering. Quote, those who study with aging hoofers have to be aware of absorbing their heaviness. Absorbing heaviness from honey coals would seem paradoxical, but Croce was advocating different expectations for female dancers, particularly a cultivated body line. I'm aware that these sexual distinctions probably don't interest the new breed of female tap dancers, but who could be interested
this
in the...
This is her, by the
this
way.
This is Arlene Croce's quote. She wrote for The New Yorker. She's one of the most esteemed dance critics of our time. So she writes, absorbing... I'm aware that these sexual distinctions probably don't interest the new breed of female tap dancers. This is in the 70s. But who could be interested in the low primate stuff they're turning out now? Croce's dismissal, it seems to me, this is Brian, unnecessarily conflated beginner's awkwardness with an African-derived dance posture well-suited to tap. That the women would absorb heaviness was less of a peril than that they would fail to absorb the aesthetic of the cool. The danger wasn't that they would look like apes. The danger was that they would look like they were aping. All of this commentary signaled another twist in the spiraling history of the imitation dance. Summer's talk about filtering and dilution, her phrase, a pale copy. She said that what women were doing was a pale copy of others. So this, you put a lot of focus on women tap dancers in your book, and in a very, very interesting way. And this is just so sort of astonishing to me that in the 70s, that kind of language would have, and thinking would have been part of our literary culture.
Sure. I mean, that's another twist of what I'm trying to get at with the title. You know, what you see versus what you hear, mm-hmm. and the way that the eye can be much more prejudicial than the ear a lot of times.
Right, right.
You know, you close your eyes, you listen to someone dancing, you don't know black, white, man, woman. You open your eyes, other things are happening.
It's fascinating. It's time for a Q&A from you.
Could you say a little bit more about the posture of tap dancing and how it helps a dancer dance tap?
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, lots of people have different postures, and part of the tradition, like Bill Robinson, you know, it's almost like he's coming out of the clogging tradition. He's so erect and upright. And then if I would show you, you know, somebody else from the same era, the Nicholas Brothers or something, the posture's quite different. It's closer to African, maybe over the feet. Some of that is the posture that is helps you make the sound. That is, maybe I'll put it another way. The sometimes people try to put tap and ballet together, and they almost never work because the first thing you need is a loose ankle, and that doesn't happen in ballet. You need to be over your. You need a tap dancer is all about shifting weight. You shift weight like so many times a second sometimes, and the posture, a bent-kneed posture, with the helps facilitate making the sounds. Does that sort of answer your question, or?
Sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, what she's talking about is that the women were learning from black men, and the black men had a kind of posture that Arlene Croce thought was not appropriate for women. It was not a feminine posture. She wanted them to look more like Eleanor Powell, or to, you know, she's in the quote, it's like cultivate body line, to be feminine in a more traditional way. And all I'm saying is that that's not the only way to dance.
I noticed the early film showed probably a wooden shoe, and I know modern shoes have metal taps on them. And what kind of shoe did our dancer wear? And on.
Sure. So, Bill Robinson, the clip we saw, is wearing a wooden shoe, and that was most common. Even in the 19th century, there was some like people nailing nails into the shoes to make a better sound, a harder sound. But it wasn't until the 20s that the metal taps began to be manufactured commercially. And that's at the same time, actually, that the word tap dancing became tap dancing. Before, we had jig, clog, buck dancing. There were a lot of other names. And it's in the 20s that the word tap dancing becomes the word for this thing.
The opportunity to interview on camera some major dancers such as Fayard Nicholas and Catherine Dunham and Lindy Hopper, Norma Miller, and so forth. And a name that came up repeatedly in interviews and also with people that were there at the time, maybe just chorus line dancers like Original Cotton Club dancers, was the name Pete Nugent. Mm-hmm. And I've never, ever found any footage of Pete Nugent. Have you? And
I have never found any footage of Pete Nugent. Pete Nugent isn't in the book. You can read about Pete Nugent in the book. Great, great tap dancer. In the 40s, they called him the Seppi of Fred Astaire. what was I going to say? I did find one bit of audio footage. One aspect of the revival that we didn't talk about was in the 60s, there was an author called Marshall Stearns, who found a lot of dancers and got them to go to the Newport Jazz Festival and some of these venues that were happening for jazz. And the Voice of America recorded some of these Newport Jazz Festival things. And on one of them, you can hear Pete Nugent tapping. It's beautiful. But it's the only footage I know of Pete Nugent. Though people still know his routines. And I know you might even know a Pete Nugent routine.
That's cool.
The Bambolina and some of his famous, actually Eddie Rector, but there are Pete Nugent routines that have been passed down.
We loved going to the theater, and very often we see renewals of old shows where tap is just delightful. I remember growing up watching old movies. James Cagney was my favorite dancer, always known as a gangster, but a great dancer.
Great dancer.
Are there new shows coming out, though? Or is tap going? Is tap coming into new musicals?
Not so much. I mean, there is it tends almost exclusively when you have tap on Broadway, it's because it's a show that's old. They're doing a revival, or they're doing a pastiche of something, and it's supposed to be in the 30s or 40s, and so you use the form of the 30s and 40s. So on Broadway, no. But there are people doing new things with it, which is one reason I really wanted you guys to see them, see that like tap is alive.
Hi, I would like to know whether you tap today, and if not, why?
I still dance, yes.
Hello. Do you mention Willie Covan in your book at all?
I do. We were talking, maybe we would talk about Willie Covan, who grew up in Chicago. His family was part of the Great Migration to Chicago and became a big vaudeville performer, and then moved out here, and he was actually one of the first black dancers in Hollywood musicals. If you find on the show, 1928, the four Covans are in it. It's like these terrible white dancers doing I don't know what, and then the four Covans come in and they're like, oh, there's some dancing, it's great. But there wasn't much work for black dancers, especially in that day. In the early days of Hollywood, blacks were almost not used at all. And what Willie did is he became a teacher, and he had a school here in Los Angeles, and he was also on the payroll at wonderful. What, that's amazing. I'd love to talk to you afterwards. And he was also on the payroll at MGM. He was one of the behind-the-scenes people that made the studio. You know, he gave steps to the Shirley Temple, to Ann Miller, part of that system.
This is 1908 that he was alive and doing this.
Right. I have some stories from his childhood, and that great story in Montana where he goes to, and he's a kid, and the cowboys are shooting at him and throwing coins, and it turns out to be gold coins, and he's pretty happy. There are lots of stories about Willie in the book.
Yeah, wonderful.
I'm curious, I haven't read the book, but can you talk a little bit about how it happened that Shirley Temple, as this little white girl, the America's sweetheart, ends up tap dancing with Bill Robinson, and what the reaction was, and so on, and some background on that?
I don't really know exactly like how that happened, except that they needed someone to play these roles. So she was always in so many of her movies were either set in the South or like just post-bellum, and so you need black actors. Bill Robinson was already known at this point. That film we saw is before the Shirley Temple era. But it is kind of amazing, sort of, that you had, there's a film critic, Donald Bogle, who calls them the first interracial couple. And it's sort of true. I mean, it's become safe. You have the little girl and the man who's over 50. That's a lot safer. Right? but I mean, there are stories Shirley Temple tells in her book, and I don't even know whether to believe it, but that they had to excise the scenes of them holding hands in the South. It's remarkable, yeah. And they were very friendly, that actually haunted him later. Some of this negative reaction I was talking about in the black community towards Bill Robinson, a lot of that I have quote the black newspapers, you giving gifts to the white girl, that kind of thing. What were you doing? Those movies and his relationship with Shirley Temple haunted his reputation at a certain extent.
Wow.
Oh, hi, thank you. Throughout your research and by watching all those movies, did you notice an evolution on the musicality of the dance itself?
Absolutely, totally. And it parallels with jazz. And there are some tap dancers who would tell you that a lot of what happened in jazz and changed was actually the tap dancers who were changing it. And you know, it's hard to tell because the tap dancers weren't recorded, and you have we can follow the history of jazz in recording a lot more than we can in tap dancing. But they were definitely there at the same time, and they were listening to each other. And you hear, you know, famous drummers talk about how they listen and learn from famous tap dancers, and the forms were definitely evolving together.
There's also a good deal in the book about Gregory Hines, who we haven't talked a lot about. But
there's a lot of people we haven't talked about.
There's so many people we haven't talked about who really kept the flame burning, and it was just it's incredible, the richness of these stories in here. We now have another treat. Yes, that's your cue.
Oh well, let's have the dancers back, and I'll put on my shoes too.
Yes, so. Sarah Reich and Danny Janklow and Brian Siebert.
Yes, we're going to jam a little bit. We're going to improvise and just have a little friendly conversation with our feet. And then we're going to jump into the shim sham, which is a very traditional tap dance. Hey, I'm sure some of you know this. Created by Leonard Reed and Willie Bryant and some women.
And if you want to learn
back
more,
in the day, if you
want
to learn, read about it. These guys, he wrote about it. So here we go. We're going to do some Lester Leaps In.
Possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.